welcome to Worlds Apart. After 9 months of inactivity, the possibility of mediating the Ukrainian war has once again hit the news. A number of foreign leaders called on Moscow to give it a thought and a try, while the backers of the Ukrainian side have come up with another ultimatum-like proposal. Does this conflict have a meaningful chance of being resolved at the negotiating table? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Benoit Paré, a former OSCE observer in Ukraine and author of What I Saw in Ukraine. Mr. Paré, it's amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for your invitation.
Now, you used to work for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which was set up back in the 1970s with the specific goal of conflict prevention and also trying to bridge the mistrust and the divide between the East and the West. And I think it's almost bitterly ironic to reflect on it now, but I wonder if to some extent we owe the current realities of the conflict in Ukraine to those peacemaking illusions of the late Cold War era.
Well, you know, the world has changed a lot since 1975 when the OSCE was created. Initially, it was called the CSE, the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe. And as you mentioned, it was meant actually to prevent a war between the East and the Western Bloc, right? The Eastern and the Western Bloc. That was the spirit of it. And this organization became the OSCE after the breaking of ex-Yugoslavia. Because during the war in ex-Yugoslavia, it was the UN, that was the United Nations, the main international missions that was trying to make the war less of a problem, if I may say, because the UN didn't have the power to stop the war. But it was not so successful, and it was the UN lost its credibility somehow. And so then international organization that seemed to be, at that moment, the most appropriate to solve conflicts in Europe seems to be the OSCE. So the major powers, the US, Europe, Russia, agreed to boost the OSCE after the fall of the ex-Yugoslavia.
I've interviewed a number of OSCE officials, and they always extolled the neutrality of their organization. It was very difficult to ask them difficult questions because they would always hide behind the screen of neutrality. But I heard you say in another interview that as an observer on the ground, the briefings that you received were not neutral. Can you talk more about that? How specifically were the observers instructed?
Well, first of all, the mission in Ukraine, it was called the Special Monitoring Mission in Ukraine. It was created in March 2014, 21st of March 2014, just after the event in Crimea. And it was in our mandate that we were supposed to be neutral. However, when I was deployed from the induction training in Kyiv, I was surprised to hear the spokesperson of the mission who was proud to say that the mission was doing a lot to communicate towards the Ukrainian public. Okay, that was fine. But when I ask, what about communication towards the other side, you know, Donetsk, Luhansk people? Well, he was very surprised by the question and then paused for a couple of seconds, not knowing what to say. And then he said, well, anyways, there's no need to talk to these people because there are no real journalists there. And if they were, they would just like spread propaganda, they would distort whatever we tell them. So there's no point in talking to them. And I was shocked because in our mandate, we were supposed to establish dialogue on the ground. That was exactly as it was said, establish dialogue on the ground with everyone. And then the spokesperson of a mission said, well, actually only with one side.
Well, it's very important that you bring up this condescending, casual sentiment that anyways, they are not worth talking to because they are not legitimate or they're not truthful, because I think it goes to the core of not only this conflict, but the entire relationship between Russia and the West. Even before the war in Ukraine, there were many instances of international disagreements, especially in the area of security, in the area of war and peace. Where the Western side would go to the great lengths to discredit or delegitimize the position of Russia or other objectors, rather than face and consider those objections at their face value. And I wonder, why is that? Why do you think it's easier to sort of drive the situation into a dead end rather than take steps along the way to arrive at some meaningful middle ground?
Well, you see, many people in the Western elites are actually biased against Russia. And I realize that. Now, I talked to in 2014 with the former NATO ambassador in Afghanistan, because I was working with him over there. And I asked his opinion about what was going on in Donbass at that time. It was just the beginning of the insurrection. And his opinion was that there was absolutely no point in talking with them. He saw them as a bunch of thieves or, you know, people unworthy to govern. And he said, no, there's nothing to negotiate with these people. You know, we just need to support Ukraine to fight them militarily. And this is what's the opinion of somebody very senior in the NATO military machine. And once I got deployed, I realized that he was not the only person who would think along these lines. And then you need to make research beyond that to understand where it comes from. And when you study authors like, you know, Zbigniew Brzeziński, you understand much more, because he explained in this book, The Great Chessboard. He basically spends a long time explaining in his book that one of the priorities of the U.S. government was to prevent Russia from becoming an empire again, as he says it. In other terms, to prevent Russia from becoming powerful again. Because the idea was that, you know, in their mind, they have to preserve American hegemony, right? So how do they do that? By trying to prevent other potential rivals from emerging. And then he said the only way, or the best way, we can actually find to prevent Russia from becoming again a strong power is to separate Ukraine from Russia. Mm-hmm. And he insists on that. Mm-hmm. And you cannot understand everything that happened afterwards without having this in mind. It was an objective of the US administration long before, since the late 90s, to separate Ukraine from Russia.
I heard you say before that you believe there is little that the Kremlin or President Putin personally could have done differently in February of 2022, because his worldview at the time was that Ukraine would attempt to retake Crimea and join NATO. So the threat would have been significantly higher had Russia not acted. But, you know, there's also lots of experts here in Russia and in the West who believe that leading up to February 2022, Russia was too restrained, too mellow, perhaps too hopeful for a diplomatic solution with the West. What do you think?
Well, we know that before that we had the Minsk agreements, right, which were signed in 2015. You know, and it was mine of my jobs, right, to try to implement these accords, or to actually observe its implementation, to be more precise. And but, you know, I could see myself as an observer that it seemed that the Western government, even my own government, didn't seem very keen on pushing for the implementation of these agreements. And I ended up realizing that it seems there was no interest at some point on the side of the French or the German governments to see those agreements implemented, which was not my impression in 2015, to tell you the truth. When I had discussion with the French embassy back then, I really thought they believed that these agreements could be implemented. But it seems there was a shift at some point, and I can't explain that because, you know, I don't have insider knowledge about the discussions at the highest level. I could only see from the ground level that, okay, there was a loss of interest. And, I mean, it's a difficult question whether it would have been possible to act differently on the side of Russia from February 2022. But as I explained in my first book, I really see with hindsight all the decisions made by the government of Ukraine and also by the USA, mm-hmm, that somehow provoked Russia. Mm-hmm. And if you try to put yourself in the shoes of the Russian government at that moment, then you can realize that there are lots of red alarms that were ringing at the same time.
I think Russia also took steps to ring those bells pretty loud. Now, I do want to ask you about Ukraine specifically, because I think it's a very interesting and perhaps special geopolitical case, because at least prior to this war, Ukraine didn't have enough of a distinct national identity to solidify itself as a state, even within its own population. And to some extent, I think its antagonistic position towards Russia was an ideological necessity as a means of national self-identification. There is this famous geopolitical dictum that states make war and war makes states. I wonder if, you know, this conflict in a way was also encouraged or welcomed as a means of minting Ukrainian statehood so that the West can later on rely upon it.
Well, the different aspects to your questions. I mean, we know that Ukraine as an independent country, it's a very young country, right? I mean, it has like by now since 1991, I don't know, 30 years of existence. But it was pretty clear for me that even when in Ukraine, when you talk to people, there was a difference of generations. If you talk to people who had memories of the Soviet Union, and younger people who did not, politically, they were pretty different, if not very different. The most nationalist people usually were the young people because they had been raised, educated under the Ukrainian system. This is the only thing they knew, right? And so they had a stronger feeling of self-identity as being Ukrainian, whereas older people from 50 and above, they still had, for many of them, nostalgia about the USSR. Not necessarily about the Soviet system, but about the fact, the idea of belonging to a bigger country. And I remember many older people in Donbass, in villages, you know, told me that it was a war between brothers. I heard that many times. And that's part of the tragedy of it. But indeed, I really felt that there was a will from the Ukrainian government to create an identity for the new Ukrainian people from very early on, and you could really feel it. And when the war even started from 2014, the patriotic education, as they called it, was very much emphasized. Mm-hmm. And it kept being emphasized year after year, actually. Mm-hmm.
Now, for a moment, let's step aside from these grand ideas of statehood and talk about the people who were actually caught in the middle. You talked as an OSCE observer to many of them. From what you saw, what is it like to be squeezed between two heavily armed forces with your own little plot of land and with your own life that's highly likely is going to be mangled by this confrontation?
Well, you know, as OSCE observers, we were not targets, right? So I never really felt a sense of danger working there for my own safety. I mean, before that, I used to work in Afghanistan, for instance, wearing a uniform, a French uniform, being part of the ISAF mission. And we were targets over there. So it's a completely different feeling, you know? So I never felt really in danger, even if at one point I was fired at, you know, I felt bullets just above my head. I explained that in my first book. And I believe it was the Ukrainian soldiers who shot at us at that moment because we were asking them not to shoot in the direction of the house of an old woman who wanted to get into her home. You know, that was the context. Apart from that incident, I didn't really feel in danger myself. But
what about the people, Mr. Perret?
I mean, it was a bit sad to observe, yeah.
What about those you talked to on the ground, those who were caught between those confrontational forces, people who had no opportunity to leave their lands, or perhaps they didn't want to do that? How do you think they felt at that moment?
Well, it was a tragedy for most of the Donbas people. Usually in the villages, it was the older people who couldn't leave because they had nowhere to go. There were many people who were displaced on both sides, and most of the time they were living in miserable conditions because we knew like the pensions, you know, were very low in Ukraine. And it was a big problem from the moment the pension system collapsed in the separatist territories because there was nothing to replace it for a while. Right. And so from one day to the next, people lost, older people lost access to their pension. It was a big problem for them. And then Russia came in with the idea of like some kind of humanitarian pension, but it was pretty low. It was like 2000 rubles a month, as I recall, you know, around that amount. It's just enough to survive. But it gets better than nothing, at least. But for most of these people, the main challenge for them was to resume their rights to having a pension on the government-controlled side, Ukrainian-controlled side. And we, in the OSCE, we were monitoring that aspect of things, which is very little talked about when you think about it. I discussed this issue with Glenn Deason in another interview for people who are interested to have details. But that was part of the big problems that there were.
Okay. Well, Mr. Perret, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back to the discussion in a few moments. Stay tuned.
Parties competing for the support of more than 100 million voters in the race for 450 seats. Who will fail and who will prevail?
In the warm spring of 1945, it felt as though world peace had come for good.
They are determined to be united with each other and with all peace-loving nations, because the ideal of lasting peace will become a reality.
I think the Cold War began with the death of Roosevelt, and Churchill was a Cold War warrior.
Churchill, had the idea, Russland, mit Hilfe der deutschen Kriegsgefangenen, das waren 100.000 Mann, nach dem Motto,
from Stettin in the Baltic, to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Operation Unthinkable and Pincer and Broiler and Bushwhacker and Dropshot, I mean, all of these were essentially plans to directly attack and destroy the Soviet Union.
Why did the peace so many had longed for give way to a new, protracted war? When exactly did the post-war world take a fateful turn?
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Benoît Perret, a former OSCE observer in Ukraine and author of What I Saw in Ukraine. Mr. Perret, over the last week or so, there has been some renewed interest in mediating this conflict. American envoys visited Moscow and Kyiv. Russian and American presidents talked over the phone for an hour. There's been a couple of world leaders who called for ending this war. Do you think anything substantive is likely to come out of it?
Well, I see two reasons behind what is happening right now. One is called midterm elections in the US, and the other one is called oil prices in the US, or worldwide, but specifically in the US.
None of them deals directly with Ukraine, though.
Yeah, but I think these are the two factors that directly influence the Trump administration's decisions right now, because they know that they are in trouble for re-election, for having Republicans to win in the U.S. They know that the Iran war was catastrophic for the image of President Trump, and it made the oil prices go up, which is very bad for somebody who's running for election in the U.S. Everybody knows that in the U.S. And so they actually messed up with Iran. And now they think, what can we do to make the prices of oil go down? Well, the only option they have is to influence the war in Ukraine, because they know that also influences the prices going up. You know, all these attacks on the Russian refineries all around the country, that basically has a bad impact on the oil prices worldwide, because, you know, there's less oil on the global market. You know, it's a mechanical effect. So I think this is what motivates the Trump administration right now. And what's also interesting is that they are trying to involve the head of the CIA, John Ratcliffe, into this game now. Because we know that in U.S. politics, the CIA tends to do its own things. You know, we know that since Kennedy. So the fact that the Trump administration is trying to involve the CIA into the negotiations would be like a sign that maybe they're serious about it. Mm-hmm. And when you read whatever came out of the proposals that were brought to Zelensky, if you believe what appeared in the press, mm-hmm. it seems that for the first time, the U.S. administration is ready to propose to Zelensky all the Russian conditions mm-hmm. to end this war. Mm-hmm. That's an interesting evolution. But it doesn't mean that Zelensky will accept, though, because Zelensky still has the support of the Europeans.
Your second book on the subject is called Ukraine, the Great Manipulation. And in it, you specifically explore Kyiv's strategy of manipulating international public opinion and, crucially, I think, setting no limits for itself. What do you think the Ukrainian leadership is actually after? What do you think their desired scenario is? Because it's very hard to understand it. Even from Moscow, there seems to be no instinct of self-preservation. They only want to continue this war so that they can play their media games further.
What I believe is that the Ukrainian government, even Zelensky, doesn't really decide for Ukraine. I think there's still people behind what we call the deep state, you know, the globalized deep state, the Western globalized deep state, is the one actually that, in my view, created this war. And they are the ones that actually continue to fuel it. You know, as Boris Johnson said, you know, if Ukraine loses this war in spite of NATO support, it's bad for the bad for NATO, because nobody will believe that NATO is a threat if we let Ukraine lose the war. So this is what is at stake for the people who are actually actors of this globalized deep state in the West. So they don't want Ukraine to stop fighting because they are afraid that it's the whole of the NATO, but we lose its relevance if it happens.
Hopefully Ukrainians can also think for themselves and care about themselves. But you argued before that this far right flank of the Ukrainian establishment are unable to accept any compromise to end the war because they would see that as a betrayal. When a mental frame is so rigid, when you don't even consider a second option, when only fighting and killing is considered a dignified position, what's the point of even trying to mediate this war?
You know, that's another problem, is that, you know, the Ukrainian nationalists, as Henry Kissinger wrote in 2014, they don't have a culture of compromise at all. And I learned that when I was deploying Donbass very quickly, when talking to the average Ukrainian soldier. For them, any compromise is betrayal. And, you know, the people that take their inspiration from, we know it's Bandera and all these people, and they were fanatics, you know. And, I mean, when you know in Russia that the Bandera people, they continued to fight even though World War II was over. And they fought a guerrilla warfare for 10 years with no hope to win. And yet they continued to fight until all of them were either dead or arrested, which is, you know, insane. But it seems like the Ukrainian nationalists who are right now heavily influencing the policy of Ukrainian states, they're in the same mindset. For them, it's better that all of them die for a cause rather than make any compromise.
Now, in your book, you describe visiting some of the buildings that were used by the Azov battalion. And from your description of it, they looked like temples to Adolf Hitler with swastikas and his hand-drawn portraits. And people tend to get drawn to the Nazi trappings, but I'm far more interested in the psychopathy underneath it. It's not just a cult. It is a cult that openly celebrates death and violence. Isn't a project like this that makes psychopathy its driving force, that celebrates it as heroic, isn't it dangerous not only for its enemies, but also for its sponsors?
Well, you know, the Ukrainian nationalists are extremists, and some of them psychopaths. I'm not saying that all of them are, but some of them are. You know, as you mentioned, I have seen these swastikas on the walls in this location that was occupied by Azov Battalion. And then, you know, I made research about the Azov Battalion, Andrei Biletsky, where do they come from? And I realized this neo-Nazism is pretty old in Ukraine. And it goes back, you know, to this review of history, a nostalgia of the years of the World War II, you know, because they thought the UPA fighters were heroes. And but you know, this myth of UPA, the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, as heroes, was heavily sponsored by the CIA for decades during the Cold War. So it doesn't come out of the blue. We know that Lebed, who was one of the lieutenants of Bandera, he immigrated to the U.S., was given U.S. citizenship, and was in charge of actually developing the new Ukrainian nationalism with the new generations, with the diaspora, and inside Ukraine itself in a clandestine manner. So they, with CIA money, they maintained this ideology alive, and they even transformed it somehow to make it more acceptable to the new generations. And these are the people now who are dominate Ukraine and decide about this policy. They are the people who have been brainwashed by this vision of history, which is very radical because it's also somehow racist because they believe in a superior race, imaginary race that they represent.
But Mr. Perry, I think that's perhaps the most important point of all, that underneath this confrontation between Russia and the West is not over Ukraine, it's not only some geostrategic disagreements, there's this whole current of eviscerating and annihilating or self-annihilating drive. And we saw something like that break out during the Second World War when, you know, rational or even cynical political intentions were quickly swept aside by all the hatred and grandiosity throughout the entire continent, if not the world. Do you think there is a meaningful chance of something like this erupting yet again in Europe?
Well, what I fear, to be honest, is that knowing how these people think, like for them, you know, any compromise is betrayal. I think that even if this war ends, for some people, it will never end. And we may face, if not a guerrilla warfare of the kind we saw in 1945, 1955, but we may see terrorism. Like, you know, with the PLO, for instance. Now, the PLO never accepted to have its land occupied. So they may think the same way. In their mind, their lands are occupied illegally, so they will never stop to fight. That's my fear, because they would never agree to whatever peace agreements would be implemented. So we'll see how it goes. But I'm not very optimistic on that side, but touch wood.
Now, even before the war in Ukraine, the Ukrainian society was quite divided. And while this war helped consolidate people around the flag, once it's over, if it's over, I'm sure many of the former divisions will resurface. Do you think the Ukrainians will be able to handle them on their own, or will they always need some sort of an enemy to project their frustrations onto?
Well, when I read the reactions of some Ukrainian people, take Yulia Mendel, for instance, you know, she used to work for Zelensky between 2019 and 2021. Now, everything she posts online is very much in favor of peace right now. And she's willing to compromise, you know, and she's not the only one. There are other Ukrainian people who have also come to realize that this war is just destroying Ukraine as a state and destroying the Ukrainian people, you know, and that there's no... they don't believe in military victory, and only fanatics would believe in that. So they are ready to accept compromise for the sake of the survival of the population. So that's the positive side, because I think more and more people in Ukraine actually realize that this is a dead end. This war is a dead end. But you still have this minority, though, that wants to fight till the bitter end, and they are still in power. So one of the priorities would be to make sure that people right now who control Ukraine, that they do not influence the policy of Ukraine anymore. So that would be one of the major stakes, you know, in future negotiations, I believe.
I see. Well, Mr. Perry, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart next week.